Chapter 5, Welcome to the Main Event.
There was a study done back in 1969 by a researcher named Walter Mitchell that will kind of help us set up what drives us to events rather than solutions. Imagine for a minute that you're 4 years old and some adult makes the following deal with you. They will give you a marshmallow right now, no strings attached. It's all yours. But if you can wait a minute, just a few minutes, and not eat the marshmallow while they run a quick errand, they'll give you two marshmallows when they get back. So as a four-year-old, you're thinking, good deal, I just have to hang out for a few minutes and I get two, no brainer. And that's what happened in his study. 4- and 5-year-old preschoolers were brought into a room, one at a time, with a small table and chairs and asked to wait 15 or 20 minutes while the researcher ran an errand. And then the researcher left and went behind a two-way mirror and studied how those kids reacted. Now, for some of the kids, there was no space between stimulus and response. The researcher shut the door and boom, the marshmallow was in their mouth. Other kids, though, struggled. They wanted to eat it, but they also wanted two marshmallows. Some tried to pretend somehow that it wasn't there, so they sang songs. Really, they did anything their little minds could conjure up to change the subject. Some of them, trying to see how far they could stretch the rules, licked it. Now, that was okay because technically, they didn't eat it. Some of the kids just went under the table to wait it out and end up falling asleep. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. After observing their initial reactions, researchers followed those same children in the experiment over the next 20 years or so, and here's what they found. Years later, as kids in high school, those who resisted their impulse and waited for the two marshmallows showed better skills under stress, embraced challenges more optimistically, and pursued goals rather than giving up in the face of difficulty. They were also found to be more confident, more trustworthy, dependable, and willing to take on more initiative than those who ate the first marshmallow instantly. The researchers also concluded that children at that young age were incapable of delaying gratification, but they had somehow learned strategies for shifting their focus or their attention to something else for a better return on investment. By the way, As a personal note, I would suggest that you don't try this with your kids because, in my case, if they eat the marshmallow, you get really bummed out as a parent. They don't care, but you know that their future's pretty grim. So here's the parallel. Events are the business version of the marshmallow. As business people, we are the kids in the room dying to eat the marshmallow. And the real solution with the highest return on investment is a whole bag of marshmallows. But we can't resist. We don't think first. We grab it and we shove it in. And the big wake-up call for Business Inc. is don't eat the marshmallow. The one marshmallow that's in front of you could be a solution. And it could easily be nothing more than an event. So wait for the real thing. Now, intellectually, it's not too hard to grasp that concept. Psychologically, emotionally, it's hard to accept. And the reason is because it's our impulse to solve, not to think first. Daniel Goleman said this, "There is perhaps no psychological skill more fundamental than resisting impulse." And we're impulsive because events are sexy. Sometimes we would like to think that there is a magic bullet, that we can somehow throw money at a situation and everything will be okay. Sometimes just talking about the event gives us mental adrenaline, and the adrenaline drives a kind of mutual conspiracy to talk about a solution before we really understand what we need and what's possible for the right solution.
I was teaching a seminar in San Francisco, and I had shared this research, and a lady in the workshop raised her hand, and she said, "I was in the study." Can you imagine the question the class wanted to ask? And in fact, before I could even get it out, they said, "Did you eat the marshmallow?" And she kind of tipped her head down and she said, I did. Now that's what we need in business. We need impulse control. That's the skill set that we're talking about. In fact, I'd like to share another example that could easily be the poster child for events that happen in companies all the time. Not long ago, I was part of a cross-functional team, and we'd been given the responsibility of implementing an enterprise resource planning system. Now, this represented a pretty significant replacement of our technology infrastructure in our company. It wasn't a small undertaking. We were replacing everything from the call center to order entry to manufacturing, distribution, inventory planning. It was a pretty big deal. So we talked to some pretty experienced outsiders who dangled these enticing and what they called proven methodologies for success. We hired two companies to help us scope the project, and we identified a budget that was approved by the board of directors for $27 million. And so our team started down this long, winding road with hope of a big return. We should also probably tell you that hope is not a method, nor is it a strategy. Once a decision is made on a solution to problems that we face in our organizations, it's very interesting. Meetings seem to multiply like wabbits. And we were no different. We were world class at it. If meeting were an Olympic sport, we would be gold medalists. I mean, we met on strategy, on direction, and team composition. We met on timelines and budgets and buy-in, all phases of the implementation. We met on end-user requirements until we were sick to death of it. We even met on the meetings we were about to have. Along a stretch of the freeway where we live, there's a billboard for a technical college that says, "Get in, get out, make bucks." Now that's what our meetings and this initiative should have been about. The long story short is that ultimately we ended up with a fully loaded price tag of $54 million. This was pretty good return on the investment for the outside consultants, that is, because all we got as a company was a pretty good set of financial reporting software. That's it. Oh, and by the way, we got some human resources stuff too. If we had actually known what we were going to get before we started, we could have done it for around $2 million. And that $2 million would have delivered a rock-solid return. See, we thought we knew what we wanted to prevent, but it ended up being a multi-million dollar, multi-year event. If we had a billboard for this project, it would have been get in, stay in, and spend bucks. We were so desperate for a solution that we were willing to accept an event. And in events, the investment, the I part of it, devours the return, or the R part. I'd like to share a contrasting story. This is about David House, who was a former Intel executive. He left to become the CEO of Bay Networks. Bay Networks happened to be in trouble. They manufactured high-tech equipment, and they were competing against such giants like Cisco and 3Com. Now, when House took over Bay Networks, rather than do the typical turnaround stuff like announcing layoffs or liquidating divisions, revisioning, remissioning, retooling, whatever, here's what he did. He taught courses. And he personally taught these courses on what he believed to be so fundamental and so basic to business: thinking like business people. Making decisions, disagreeing openly, engaging in straight talk, managing for results, focusing on what's important. That's what he was teaching them to do. And eventually, everyone in the company was what they called house trained. Now, he applied his version of business think to the company's most serious problems, and he taught his people new ways of thinking and working together. So with well-trained business people, they started to get solutions that took over the events that they were used to. And the solutions were funded, and events got canceled. The resources were reallocated on the priority issues. Here's what started to happen. Bay Networks began to develop a shared mental operating system that led to a culture, a whole culture of business-ready, decision-savvy people. They recovered from their $285 million loss in fiscal 97, and they posted an $89 million profit in the first 6 months of the following year. That following June, Nortel agreed to buy Bay Networks in a deal that was valued at $9 billion. In telling this story, we don't intend for you to believe that once you business think, somehow magically the sun, the moon, and the stars will all align themselves. Nortel is currently tanking, and House is no longer at the helm of the company. In fact, here's a comparison that will really demonstrate the danger of slipping. If you had bought $1,000 worth of Nortel stock 1 year ago, as of this recording, it would now be worth $49. Now, on the other hand, if you had bought $1,000 worth of Budweiser beer, and I'm talking about the beer, not the stock, if you bought that and you drank all the beer and then just traded in the cans for the nickel deposit, you'd have 79 bucks. Stuff happens. Conditions change, and business thinking always needs to be responsive, to evolve with the feedback that each decision elicits.
There's a great scene in the movie Jurassic Park that kind of illustrates this point. Jeff Goldblum plays a mathematician and a theorist named Dr. Malcolm, and he's kind of invited to go check out the park to evaluate it. And at one point in the movie, he and some colleagues are having dinner with the creator of the park, who is named John Hammond. And Hammond is sitting there explaining all the great discoveries of science that have never been made before. And as he's sharing all this stuff, at a point in the conversation where you could tell Malcolm had had enough, he interrupts him and says, "I'll tell you the problem with the scientific power you're using here. It didn't require any discipline to attain it. You stood on the shoulders of geniuses to accomplish something as fast as you could. And before you even knew what you had, you patented it and you packaged it and you slapped it on a lunchbox. Your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could that they didn't stop to think if they should." See, when business think is working, it answers the Jurassic Park question. Of all the things you could do as a business, what are the vital few you should do? Are you, as a team or a company, so preoccupied with the coulds that you don't stop to think whether or not you should? Is there any discipline to attain the solutions you land on where you work? If there was just one message that Dave and I could deliver to get through to business people, it would be, just because you can does not mean you should. The coulds are okay when you're thinking through the issues, but when they're not killed and they somehow survive to suck people and time and money into them, they become dangerous distractions. If you had all the time, people, and money in the world, you could enthusiastically spend it and then just wait and see what worked, what failed. Not exactly how business works. With unlimited choices and limited resources, coulds kill a lot of businesses. So to make sure you're consistently landing on the shoulds and not the coulds means that the decisions you make will lead to solutions, not events, that produce a return or impact for the time, people, and money you're investing. That's where the reality of return on investment enters the picture. Business isn't solely a cause with great ideas. Causes are important, and great ideas can be compelling, inspiring, and still go out of business quickly. It's not just about mission. In business, there is no mission without money. I love this quote from Jim Collins and Jerry Porras in Built to Last. They say, "Profit is like oxygen, food, water, and blood for the body. They are not the point of life, but without them, there is no life."
Now, Steve brings up an interesting point about solutions. There should be an ROI. The missing piece in many of the decisions that we make is an accurate and a complete picture of the R, or the return part, of the ROI equation. You see, ROI is the whole formula. It's not only the investment, nor is it just simply about the return. Think about the last key decision you made, or a solution that you saw ignited in your company. How clear was the R to you and to others? How clear was the return or the impact to clients or to the market? See, in far too many cases, it's not easy to find, and a lot of people don't know how to get it. Or maybe they've just quickly and hastily set their sights on the investment part of the equation. They get consumed by how much is this going to cost. And sometimes they do that just because they don't really believe in the return. If the R is unclear to you, the I turns into a C, which stands for the cost. And by the way, the cost is always too high. There's another formula that we like to use in business that's like the ROI. It's called sales minus cost equals profit. Now, the reason you want a solution in the first place is because you have a belief that a solution would help you affect that equation. Either it'll help you increase your sales, or somehow it will decrease some cost in the business, either one of which or both would help you increase profit. Now, frequently, when we implement solutions, the solution actually gets in the way of sales, or it drives up costs, or both, and they have the net effect of shrinking the profits that you are hoping for. The thinking behind every decision you make, every solution you create, affects the company. It might not be measured. It might not even be noticed. It will have an impact. So in your pursuit of ROI and the sales minus cost equals profit formula, be prepared. You will be bombarded by events from every different direction, and they'll all have a ring of a solution. Departments, vendors, your company, the people you know, they'll all expect you to do that. And by the way, you do your fair share of bombarding others for the same thing. So when you're feeling big pressure to solve big problems in your company, it's real easy to turn to features and benefits of the coulds. And you're easily deceived into believing that you are in fact solving something. Features are just that, features, they're things. And the benefits are only benefits if they're lined up with the real relevant needs you're trying to address in your company. So discussing features and benefits before you even have identified the problem and clearly defined an opportunity, that's not real thinking. That's what we call hallucinating. And you're not the only one deliriously happy to dream about solutions. Vendors will come in and they'll wax sublimely rhapsodic about all the things that they could do to help your company. How many companies, by the way, do you think have created events thinking that they were actually going to provide a solution, a benefit to their company, when in fact they were the wrong thing to do? We do things like, well, let's pursue customer segmentation, or I think we should adopt a lower pricing strategy. Ooh, hey, maybe we should merge or acquire a new business. Let's expand our product line. Let's form a strategic alliance. All of these could be viable solutions if, in fact, the problem or the opportunity actually matches the solution. Otherwise, they're only events. You can probably look around your company and quickly identify a number of lethal events you and others have administered to your company Kevorkian style. Because when events are mistaken for solutions, there's some serious downsides. The crucial underlying business issues remain uncovered. That's when we start to mistake activity for productivity and progress, and it's not. And our costs start to go up, and the chronic problems we suffer from are not solved. If our addiction to fake solutions and events is so paralyzing and often leads to us going out of business, how do you break the habit?